A piece of anti-trans legislation drops on Jones Street. Could medical marijuana be closer to legalization in the Old North State? And Governor Roy Cooper making his latest push for Medicaid expansion. It's all ahead on the Politics Podcast from WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for downloading and tapping play, as usual. State lawmakers were away for spring break this pollen-dusted week, but still plenty of notable policy proposals to touch on. Here for our weekly review are Aisha Du with the progressive organization Higher Heights and Clark Reamer, former chair of the North Carolina Young Republicans. This conversation was recorded Friday morning.
Hey.
Good afternoon.
An anti-transgender bill was filed Tuesday by three Republican senators. The measure prohibits medical professionals from providing gender-confirming hormone treatment, puberty blockers, or surgery. Under the proposal, medical professionals would face a $1,000 fine and potential loss of license for violation. To be clear, this bill would be vetoed if it ever gets to the governor's desk, and it would undoubtedly lead to major economic repercussions. What is the rationale behind this bill? Aisha?
You know, I honestly don't understand it. It is just going too far. It's unnecessary. And I am hopeful that it won't move forward. I know that something of the same nature just made it to the governor's desk in Arkansas, and he actually vetoed it also. So I think that for those who are looking at what's good for students, people, children, and business, this is not something that's going to move forward in our state.
It's a complex issue. Our society is always recognized that certain things are not appropriate for children, for kids. Whether it's smoking at 21 or drinking now or driving and voting at 18 or 16, as transgender rights become more and more accepted in our society, this is a conversation we are going to have about when it's acceptable to make these sort of life-altering decisions and when we think that you are mature enough to make these decisions. Now, it's not about saying we dislike anyone or anything else. It's just a conversation we need to have as a society. And it's probably a sign we're moving forward.
You'd think a proposal that would ban doctors from doing hormone treatment and surgery is a sign we're moving forward?
It's a sign our society is discussing the issue in a way that we're dealing with the hard issues.
You know, I think that if that's the way that you want to frame it as a discussion, well, then let's have the discussion. It surely does not need to be, though, something that's actually limited or limiting. And I think the challenge is that because it's not currently limited, it feels less like a conversation because it seems more like a bill that's moving forward to actually cause restrictions. And you know, when we had this happened previously as it related to transgender and LGBTQ rights, it really, really, really had a negative effect on our state as far as those who wanted to be here and do business with us. So, you know, I wish a conversation didn't take place in the form of a restrictive proposal.
Clark, one follow-up I have for you is, well, what's the benefit to the state of North Carolina, to the people of North Carolina, to having such a proposal on the books?
Well, I think, you know, polling data will show that a lot of North Carolinians are very uncomfortable with the idea of children making these sorts of life-altering decisions early in age. So drawing some sort of bright line, which we do with many things, and saying, you know, I'm not trying, you know, no longer are we talking about what bathroom you can go in as an adult. We're talking about when these decisions can be made. And this is a new conversation. We're moving past 2,000 years of Christian tradition really quickly, really in the last 50 years, and there's going to be some uncomfortable moments as part of that.
Let me make a couple of contextual points here. Now, if either of you want to add or push back or nuance any of these, I would encourage you to do so. Number one, we've seen a series, I don't have a hard number in front of me, but we've seen a series of bills relating to transgender people across the country. Some of these relate to sports, interscholastic sports, and others relate to hormone treatment and surgery and other things under the medical purview. That's one. Number two, this bill, as presently written, from my perspective, isn't really enforceable. There would be a major question here about how this would really be implemented, whether it be the medical board or DHHS, for anybody to kind of follow up on this. And I will use that to dovetail into the third point. And this, for me, is a little bit of a historical context. A few years back, the legislature passed something called the STOP Act, which Clark might be more familiar with than Aisha, only because he was in the building and this was a prominent piece of legislation that moved. The STOP Act was an opioid bill dealing with the epidemic 4 years ago. And I couldn't help but think of the STOP Act this week because one of the things that came out of that bill were limits for doctors in prescribing opioids. It was for acute care and not chronic care. And I remember at the time, I'm not a medical professional, I talked to Greg Murphy, who was a Republican in the State House. He's now, of course, a Republican in the U.S. House. He's now a member of Congress. And I asked Murphy why there wouldn't be limitations on the prescribing for chronic pain and chronic issues, but just acute care. Think after surgery, after some sort of trauma. And what he and a number of other lawmakers said to me, Republican and Democratic, if I do remember correctly, was that we had to give doctors flexibility. We couldn't we didn't need to have too many restrictions placed on doctors. We had to trust them. They were the medical professionals. So, and I guess I will pose one more question back to you, Clark. If you would delineate for me what the difference is between that 4 years ago when it was like, hey, we got to give doctors flexibility here. They're the professionals, they're the experts. And this instance where it's like, oh, we're going to tell doctors they cannot do this whatsoever. And just to underscore it one more time, one is a global epidemic that we know about. There is a heroin epidemic. The other is this issue where I'm not sure it's as prevalent as, say, the prescribing of opioids.
Again, I think the big difference here is we're talking about healthcare for children, and that's always been a little different than it has been for adults, and what needs to happen and what decisions they are capable of making to affect their long-term life.
I mean, it's a critical issue. It's really nuanced and it's really hard. And I think that it still, though, should be the decision of the parent and the child on how they move forward. You know, for people that I've not known personally, but for things that I've seen of stories where these children just really have a very, very hard time trying to live and really be in a body they feel like they're not supposed to be in. And so it becomes really, really problematic to the point that when you look at number one, transgender, black transgender women are highly targeted, number one. So that's a challenge as far as actually being murdered and killed. And then when you look at bullying and all the other issues that these children deal with, there's a higher suicide rate among LGBTQ children. So this is not something to be taken lightly by any stretch of the imagination. It's just that I don't think that restrictions really make a difference. And although there may be a nuance in how people can move forward and it's not enforceable, I think that it's a really challenging road to go down.
Meanwhile, teachers would have to give equal time to the viewpoints of both major political parties as part of the Balanced Political Discussion in Classrooms bill. I should perhaps note that we in the press were long held to an equal time rule. Enacted in 1927 for radio, the Fairness Doctrine was abolished 34 years ago. Some Republicans are displeased with the social justice lessons at some public schools. We should note this bill would not apply to charters. Clark, a serious question. Is this a serious bill?
Yeah, I think it is a serious bill. I think we're seeing more and more indoctrination in our school system. We see the new social studies standards that really have a left-wing bent to them. And so we're saying, you know, you have to give a certain amount of equal discussion to both sides and both viewpoints. If you go back to the fairness doctrine, you know, the concept behind that is that the airwaves were a public good, and that therefore anything was supported as a public good and a public right. And while they're still regulated by the FCC, is that we got rid of the fairness doctrine because there's a multitude of avenues for public discourse now between online, cable TV, broadcast TV, radio. So it's perhaps not as important for that particular venue to give equal time to both sides. But when we're talking about something that's supported by taxpayer dollars like public education, then we really do need to say this is not a place to politicize. And if you're going to politicize, then we have to show both sides.
Clark, can you give me an example of something that from your perspective has been over-politicized or that has taken an unfair or inaccurate left-leaning bent within the social studies classrooms of North Carolina, public school K through 12?
Certainly, there's been a lot of controversy over the new social studies standards and their discussion of the founding of America and what that was about. So I think there's a huge example there. The lieutenant governor just founded an accuracy commission. I forget the exact name that he gave to it, but there's a lot of concern there and a lot of issues.
Can you give us one, just one specific? I recognize that the lieutenant governor has been front and center on this issue, but is there a particular, whether it's terminology that is part of those new social studies standards, or if it is a way in which the founding fathers chapter, so to speak, of American history is being taught that is particularly problematic to you? Okay. No. Okay. Aisha, go ahead.
You know, I think that this is just going to be an increasingly challenging conversation in the sense that I think that what we're calling social justice now should really just be called an ever improving democracy. There was a story, and I may misquote where it landed. Perhaps it was the Wall Street Journal, or maybe it was the Washington Post, New York Times, I don't quite remember, but it was the article basically spoke to the idea, the notion, the history that every time our democracy improved, it improved because of Black people, right? Or because of the struggle of Black people being actualized, being that we moved from slavery to freedom, being that we moved from Jim Crow and beyond. So the reality of it is that I think that we are still in a place of constant improvement, and we still have freedoms that have not been fully actualized. And sometimes it's easier to look at the bigger picture and think, okay, well, now we have integrated schools, and now we actually don't. And so that means that we've moved forward and we are in a place where we're definitely all equal. But when you look at even the pay rate for men as opposed to women, women's equal pay day is behind men's equal pay day. Black women's equal pay day is behind that. And then Native American women's equal pay day is beyond that. So there's still metrics that we can still pay attention to where there's not equality. And if we're not having the conversation, then we're not going to get there.
I just say we're not talking about equality here. We're talking about how we present the history of this country. And, you know, I think what is concerning to many is the idea of this country as a fundamentally racist product that has been put out there by many. Certainly we have made mistakes and done things that were wrong. But it's a question of framing. It's a question of whether you look at our aspirations or our mistakes as the truth behind this country, as what is fundamental.
I mean, we were founded with 200 years of slavery. So the reality of it is that we have been repairing ourselves ever since the founding of our actual country, and aspiring to change and aspiring to a new level of greatness is wonderful. We need to pay attention to our history, the moment, the current moment, and what's happening. Because as far as I'm concerned, we took several steps back on January 6th. So we still need to have the conversation about what's happening right now. And if we're not having that conversation, then we're not moving forward.
Is racism a fundamental founding part of the beginning of American history and independence?
It's a part of our history, but I don't think it's a part of our foundational ideas. In fact, it was our foundational ideas that allowed us and brought us to ending slavery through the Civil War, to the Civil Rights Act. It's those great foundational ideas of liberty and all people being created equal that make this country what it is. And to ignore that, or at least downplay that and say that it is there's a foundational racism to this country, I think takes us in a direction that is more a step backwards than a step forwards. We should embrace those ideas of liberty and democracy and equality that our country is founded on. And that is what is excellent about our country.
But we did have slavery for the first almost 100 years of our country.
We did. And frankly, so did the rest of the world. We fought a war to get rid of it. And it was controversial then, even at the founding of our country.
Let's be clear. I don't think that the structural issue that we're talking about is limited to the United States of America. What I can say is that we still have here in my house, you know, the picture of my great-great-grandmother and her obituary that said that she was a great mammy, her picture from out of slavery. So the reality of it is that we, at the end of the day, my grandmother was one third human, and so viewed as one third human. She was not one third human. I am not one third human, and none of us are. But we have to deal with the reality that that has set the tone, set the tenor, and the direction of our country for quite some time. Have we overcome? Will we continue to overcome? Yes. And that means we have to continue the conversation so that we can chip away at some of the things that may not be as evident.
We'll transition to a much lighter topic, no pun intended, but perhaps someone will chuckle once we get into this next topic. Medical marijuana legalization bills have for years gone nowhere at the legislature. But this week, Republican Bill Rabin, one of the most powerful members of the state Senate, filed legislation to permit medical cannabis for a range of conditions, cancer, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis among them. Recreational marijuana would remain illegal. Is this bill a good one for the people of North Carolina? Aisha, you start this time.
You know, I've worked with a number of people in the state legislature who supported medical marijuana for quite some time. Representative Kelly Alexander is one of them. And so, I mean, I think that this is the time, right? I mean, it's happening in other states where marijuana is being fully legalized. I don't know that we're going to become Denver, Colorado tomorrow. But I think that legalizing medical marijuana is a step in the right direction.
Much like sports gaming, this is happening all around us. I think it is eventually going to pass in North Carolina. And I think that Senate Rules Chair Senator Rabin sponsoring this bill is a game changer for this issue. He generally doesn't do things lightly. I would not expect him to do to sign on to this bill if he didn't think it was going to go somewhere. I think that Chairman Dixon in the House, Representative Hurley, Representative McElrath, a number of others. There's going to be a lot of questions about this bill, and it's got a long process to go through, but we'll see what happens. I think it's going to be a big deal.
One more topic. Governor Roy Cooper is again pushing Medicaid expansion, the federal program for people living in poverty and or with a disability. 12 states have not expanded under the Affordable Care Act. Cooper has been pushing this for 5 years, thus far with no success. The governor joined the Politics Podcast from WUNC earlier this week and said changes in the landscape make him optimistic. Greater federal incentives for expanding, an overhaul of the already existing Medicaid program here, and that the pandemic has led to an even greater need for care. Do either of you sense that expansion is actually any closer to happening? Clark?
I think the conversation has shifted both from the governor and from the legislative side. I don't know if we will get to expansion or expansion that's not called expansion or exactly where we will go, but I think you will see some sort of compromise in the upcoming year or two.
That's the hope that I'm looking for my country and my North Carolina. I mean, this has just been a long-term conversation. And I think that Governor Cooper really hit the nail on the head. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We now have an opportunity to take part in Medicaid expansion. And we don't even have to, with no financial investment, I think, what, through 2023. So this is good for the people of North Carolina. I do think the conversation is moving. I'm hopeful that it's moving, and I'm hopeful that it will move quickly for all of those who need health care.
Clark Riemer is the chief of staff for Republican State House member Jason Sain. Aisha Du is the political director at the organization Higher Heights. Enjoy your weekends.
Thank you.
Take care.
Enjoy yours.
Support for this podcast comes from NC Modernist's Monday newsletter, committed to documenting and preserving 2,400 mid-century modern houses around North Carolina. Subscriptions at ncmodernist.org or by texting modernist to 22828. I referenced that conversation with Democratic Governor Roy Cooper. That is in your podcast feed from Tuesday, the WUNC Politics podcast feed. Encourage you to listen to that and also to catch up on the latest episodes of Tested, Embodied, Dating While Gray, and of course head over to WUNC.org, listen to the reporting from my colleagues. For Aisha and Clark, I'm Jeff. Hope you do enjoy your weekend. We'll talk to you again soon.